Okay, thank you, Rabbi Hochberg. Thank you all. My voice is still a little bit on the fritz. It was worse a few days ago, so hopefully the new room alignment will help us out somewhat, maybe. Anyway, it's good to be back. Just to bring us back up to the acoustics in this room, incidentally, I feel loud, which is funny because I have a soft voice. I seldom feel loud, so you guys are doing something right, and I'm very appreciative of that. Just a quick summary of what we did last time, both for those who were here and those who were not here. So Megillat Rut is all about chesed. It's just this wonderful, happy, everybody's so nice and lovely, all that good stuff. The ambiguities that we discussed last week had more to do with what is God's specific role in the Sefer. God is in charge of everything, but what is our narrator, what does the author of Megillat Rut want to get across in terms of God's role? How much is God acting in this story, and how much is it human behavior that is acting? We spent a bunch of time dealing with that particular point. We also had some interesting conversations about, should we view Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion as having died for their sins, or do we see it much more in terms of they just died, and maybe they died for sins, maybe they didn't, it's simply not important to Megillat Rut, and it's far more about, okay, the menfolk are now dead, and now we can get to our story, which is about the womenfolk, about Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, and eventually Naomi and Ruth, and how they figure all of these things out. This is not a trivial debate. It has everything to do with what the message of Megillat, or what the messages of Megillat Rut are all about. I just wanted to start off, before we do the shiur for tonight, with one pasuk that really is the kicker on this subject. It's Perek Bet Pasuk Kaf. I hope that at some point John and all the other Chumash schleppers, you know, some extra schar for carrying art scroll Chumashim in abundance for this sort of thing. So I thank all of those who took the time and trouble to bring it up. But if you look at Perek Bet Pasuk Kaf, this pasuk encapsulates our dilemma for the entire Megillah. And in my opinion, it's not a dilemma that we're going to resolve. I think that the Megillah specifically keeps us tantalized in this regard. If you know the story, what happens is, you know, in chapter 2, Perek Bet, which we'll look at next time, Rut, it's one of those good biblical coincidences. As fate would have it, Rut just happened to show up in Boaz's field, and that's where she chose to glean. Not because she knew that Boaz was the man, but because she went down the block, and lo and behold, here's a field that looks like there's reaping going on. I think I'll glean here. Okay, so that's good old biblical coincidence at its finest. All things turn out very nice. So when she comes home with an inordinate amount of grain for your average gleaner, so Naomi picks this fact up. She says, whoa, that's a lot of sheaves. What's going on? So she says, oh, you know, I just happened to come across some guy, his name is Boaz, and you watch Naomi's light bulb go on. It is fantastic, right? And in Perek Bet Pasuk Kaf, she realizes that good things are about to happen. Batomer Naomi lechalata. So Naomi says to her daughter-in-law, Ruth, Baruch hu Lashem asher lo azav chasdo et hachayim et hametim. Okay, here's the ambiguity. One of my teachers, Professor Mordechai Cohen of Yeshiva University, wrote a whole article on this, that, what I just read here. And it was a long article. And it was a very good article. And I'm convinced by it. I think that once I read this, I realized this is really what it's all about. Translate. Baruch hu Lashem. Blessed is he to God. Who is the he? Boaz. Good. Asher lo azav chasdo. Who has not abandoned his loyalty. Okay, so who didn't abandon his loyalty? Who's the subject of that part? Oh, I'll see, here you go. That proves that we're in a shul. There's a debate already. But in fact, it's true. It could very well be modifying that Hashem hasn't abandoned his chesed to our family. And it could well be that she's praising Boaz to Hashem because Boaz hasn't abandoned his loyalty to our family. So Professor Mordechai Cohen says the reason why our Mefarshim are so ununanimous, they debate this point, is because the syntax simply can go just as well either way. There is no good way to resolve this particular issue. So he makes a case based on this pasuk that the whole Megillah sort of reads this way also. That you can read the whole thing as, here's divine retribution for Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion. That's the part that we spoke about last time. And later on, here's divine reward for the tremendous chesed of Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz. It's one track. And the other track is, no, it's all about how Boaz and Naomi and Ruth do amazing things to one another and within their society. And so the outcome is what you hope for people who are Balei Chesed, that good things should happen to them. And the whole Megillah, this is a microcosm of the whole Megillah, and basically a microcosm of our whole discussion. Now there's one methodological point. I like methodology. I don't think you can go too far without methodology. Yeah?
Sorry, what would be the chesed that Hashem did for Ramach
and Lechaya? Asher lo azav chasdo et hachayim et ve'et hametim. Oh, so he's helping us, the living ones, because Boaz is now going to get involved. That's always good. Boaz is going to help the dead in a very big way.
No, not Boaz. He says Hashem.
So Hashem, so the same thing. So Hashem, because divine coincidence has Ruth and Boaz meeting in the field, Naomi realizes that Hashem is good, because now we're going to have chesed im hametim. What's the chesed im hametim? What happens? When Boaz and Ruth get married and have a child, that child upholds the title, the name of Mahlon, the deceased husband of Ruth. So either way, it's the same chesed im hametim, whether she's praising Boaz for doing that, or whether she's praising Hashem for doing that. But either way, Mahlon's childless existence is now going to be redeemed. That's Pshitash HaMikra. That's the Yibum-esque. It's not halachic Yibum in our story. It's Yibum-esque. In other words, that as a result of the marriage between Boaz and Ruth, Mahlon's title continues on through this marriage. It's not just a typical shidduch situation. Okay. So that's that. Now, methodologically speaking, one of the things which we had lots of conversations about last week, and we'll get right back in it today, is that it's very important. There's such a thing as pshat, and there's such a thing as drash, and I like fussing about all these things all the time, and I love both dimensions of interpretation, but very often we tend to blur them. That's one of the great hazards of religious learning, is that pshat represents the primary original intent of the author. That's how it should be defined. Doesn't always mean the literal reading. You ask anybody reading Shir HaShirim, what's pshat? It might not tell you that it's the literal reading. They might say that the intended meaning is something else, some kind of allegorical reading. For example, if you ask Rambam, is the literal reading of Yad Hashem pshat? He would say, if you think that the literal reading of God having a hand is pshat, not only are you wrong, but you are outside of the camp of believers. In other words, there very, very emphatically, the literal reading is not the pshat. Right? So that's what pshat is, the primary original intent of the author. Drash is actually two totally different things. We use it colloquially in two totally different ways. And I remember, I only figured this out when I was writing a book review for Tradition years ago. And I was trying to figure out, like, I loved the book, but there was something that was bugging me. So I had to sit there for a while until I figured out, oh, this is what's bugging me. We use the word drash in two totally different ways. One kind of drash is a deeper layer of intended meaning of the author. It's not the primary meaning, that's what pshat is, but it's still there, it's latent in the text. Another one is when rabbis, it doesn't have to be rabbis, anybody making a drasha, uses a text as a springboard for his or her own ideas. Right? In which case, it's not even a latent meaning of the text that you have in front of you. It's that you're using the text that you have in front of you as some kind of inspiration for some other idea. A very important idea, to be sure, but not necessarily anything to do with the original intent of the text. So what's actually going to happen tonight, all in just 50 minutes or less, is I'm going to give two shiurim. And if this causes my head to spin, I don't know what it will do for you. It's very hard for me to give two shiurim at a time in one thing. And the reason why I want to give two shiurim in such a short amount of time is because I'm actually persuaded completely by both of them, even though they're completely at odds with each other. And the goal, at least what I hope we walk away with, is that there's a possibility that Megillat Ruth is doing something intentionally with us, namely to try to pick up on a very complex reality. That on the one hand, everything is so smooth and simple and wonderful. On the other hand, things are a little more complicated than that. And so we'll see how it all unfolds. We're going to backpedal a little bit in the text just to bring us all up to speed. Today's shiur is all about Naomi, and we're at Perek Aleph Pasukhet. Now we're actually up to where we're at. We actually read several psukim past where we are right now. Vatomer Naomi l'shtei chaloteha. We already know the backdrop. Elimelech, Mahlon, Kilion are already dead. Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, are heading back. And now, Naomi is going to try to dissuade her daughters-in-law from returning with her. She would like for them to remain in Moab, or at least tries to persuade them to do so. Pasuchet. Va'tomer Naomi l'shtecha loteha. So Naomi tells her two daughters-in-law, Lech nashov na'isha lebet ima. Each one of you should go back to her own mother's house. Yas Hashem imachem chesed, kasher asitem imametim v'imadi. May God do great acts of kindness and loyalty to you, the way that you have done to your former husbands who are now deceased, and to me. Yitena Hashem lachem umtzena menucha, isha beit isha. And God should, in this context, menucha literally just means rest or peace of mind. In this context, it means may you find each find a good shidduch, right? And she makes that very clear, that each one of you should find a husband here in Moab. Vatishach lehem vatisena kolan vativkena. So she kisses them and everybody cries because it's a very emotional scene. Remember, they've been together for over 10 years. Vatomer Naomi, shov na benotai. Excuse me, I skipped a pasuk. Yud. Vatomar na la, ki itach nashuv lamech. No, we shall go back with you to your nation. Vatomer Naomi, shov na benotai. Lama te lach naimi, haod li panim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem lanashim. Go back, stay here, stay in Moab. What do you have? What do I have for you? I don't have any children in my womb. Shov na benotai lech na chizakanti miyod li'ish ki amarti yesh li tikva gam hayiti alayla li'ish v'gam yalati banim. Even if, in theory, I were to marry, and even if I were to have children, even though I'm too old, even if this all were to happen, alahen tesaberna, arashay yigdalu, are you really going to put your lives on hold and wait for them to grow up until they are of marriageable age? Alahen te'agena levilti hayod li'ish, are you going to become agunot while you wait for them to grow up? Albinotai, ki marli me'od mikem ki atzabi yad Hashem. Life is very bitter, God is against me. God has struck against me. Batisena kolan batipkena od batishak orpa lachamota v'rut davikaba. So once again they cry, and this time Orpa realizes my mother-in-law has a point. I think I shall stay in Moab right now. Pasuk tetvav, v'tomer, hine shava yivimtech, elamav elaloha, shuvi achare yivimtech. So now, one down, one to go. Naomi turns to Ruth and says, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her nation and her gods. You should go back after her. Wherever you go, I shall go. Wherever you sleep, I shall sleep. Amech ami, your nation is my nation, ve'elohayich Elohai, and your God is my God. Wherever you shall die, that's where I will be. I swear to God that only death will separate us. So, just one question tonight, really. So, why does Naomi want her daughters-in-law to go back? It's in her interest, after all, to have her daughters-in-law come with her, I think. And after all, Ruth does go back with her in the end, and she takes very good care of her by gleaning. What in the world is Naomi going to do without the two people who care about her the most? So it's amazing that she wants them to remain. So why does she want them to remain?
She's looking after their future. She feels they have more of a future, more of a possibility of marrying Moab, and I'm going back to Israel, and trying to find a ministry.
Very good. So her words are 100% that. She's saying, what do I have for? I have nothing to offer you. I have no other children. Even in theory, were I to get pregnant tomorrow, okay, great, so wait 9 months and then another 13 or so years. Don't do that to yourself. Stay here, find husbands, the end. Good, so she's looking out for their interests. Okay, good. Now the advantage that you have is that's 100% what she says. Are there any other possibilities? You're for sure some of the story, and that she's totally lying. But I trust her because she's so lovely, yeah. Okay, how so?
Because her daughter-in-law, she would have to explain who they were, and they could be an embarrassment to her. Her sons died, because they married non-Jewish women or whoever, and who are these people?
Okay, so here we have a possibility of that somehow they'll be embarrassing to her. She has a story to explain, they're from Moab, we don't like Moabites too much. Okay, good. Yeah?
They're going to be a burden to her.
How so?
Well, she'll have to support them, she'll have to feed them, until they do find spouses.
Also, all of a sudden, now there's three mouths to feed instead of one. It's like, great, I'm a beggar already, but now there's two more beggars, and I have responsibility to them. Okay.
What's fascinating is that Naomi always talks about God. It's not real life. And even Ruth answer to her, your God is my God, is a God intoxicating.
Is a God what?
Intoxicating answer.
I love God intoxicating answers. It's great. It's a fabulous expression to boot.
This is not how normal people thought. No, it's
really.
In every pasuk that she says, there's God's name. Naomi.
This is a good thing.
Look at it.
What? Yes, she mentions God a lot. I think that that's favorable.
I mean, her husband, that's why he went away.
Huh?
Abimelech didn't do it. He ran away from God and from his country and from his people.
Okay. I don't know. I'm not understanding the why you're finding it bothersome that biblical characters mention God in the context of their lives. I think it's fairly common. Megillat Esther is unusual by not having that. Right? Yeah.
I just thought, like, when we started, what she said after Orpah, so you have your God and it's not my God, so you should stay here with your people and your God and don't go with me because I'm going to my people and my God, and there will be maybe kind of a God contradiction, like maybe these two gods will not be able to live together, so you better stay here. Because where I'm going, you will not be welcome. People will not welcome you.
Well, if she remains pagan, then yeah, that she has a lot of strikes against her. That's for sure. And if that's what you're driving at, then I for sure agree. I don't think there's anything weird about her mentioning God. I think it would be strange if a pagan Moabite, as opposed to a monotheistic former pagan Moabite, comes back. Yeah.
Well, doesn't the answer to your question really turn on whether we believe that Rut was Miskayer before or now? In other words, it's really perplexing why Naomi would even think of sending her back if she had already been Miskayer. I mean, why send her back to Moab? That's bad. So this would suggest. So I think the answer to your question would turn on that question, wouldn't it?
It might. But I don't know if it has to. What you're saying is certainly very plausible. In other words, it's easier to say that they haven't converted yet. I think that you're right. And that way, Naomi has no religious responsibility. She's saying, look, right now you're pagans, and I'm going back to monotheism land. And you're going to be in the wrong place. It goes back to what they were saying before. As opposed to Ibn Ezra's view that they converted already. In which case, he views Ruth's affirmation here as a reaffirmation. No, I actually really meant it originally. Right, so I think it still could work within Ibn Ezra's thing, but there's no question that you're right, that the Midrashic line that they haven't yet converted and this is Ruth's moment, it's better. It's a smoother reading that way. Yeah?
Are you working the assumption that Ruth and Orpah were members of the royal household?
I'm not running on any such assumption. Why?
Well, because if they were, then would it make sense that Naomi would fare better staying in Moab than going back?
You mean Ruth and Orpah?
No, Naomi.
Naomi. Why? Because...
Back.
Well, that's her home.
Her in-laws are loyalty.
Right, but I wouldn't... That's bringing a Midrashic line into Pshat. In other words, No, I mean, look, I can't tell you that they weren't princesses, right? I don't know. But our story doesn't ride on that point at all. There's nothing about the background of Rut and Orpah that's significant to Megillat Rut. We discussed the Midrashic line last week in terms of what it might teach, which I think it teaches great things. But I don't know that it's what Megillat Rut is intending. Okay, yeah?
Though the kindness is kind or kind words, they also remind her of everything that went wrong. She says, Ki marli moed mikem.
Oh. So you're already hitting on a different dimension, which we're going to play around with a bunch tonight. When you have two shiurim to go, you realize that, okay, that point needs to come in. It depends how you translate that pasuk, and the way you just translated it is significant. And we're going to get back to your point, yeah?
Yeah, I was going to say, they were Miskayer beforehand, but she may be saying to you, Miskayer, to get married, but now look what happened, your husband's a guy. I'm going to leave and go back, and maybe you want to change your mind. This is your last chance. Maybe you want to go back to the way you were before.
Right. Within Ibn Ezra, basically, that's how you would understand it. Going back to John's point, yeah. Okay, so we have a lot of different reasons floating around for why Naomi may have tried to dissuade her daughters-in-law for going back, ranging from the only thing that she says, which is, I'm looking out for your interests, and a lot of other things. Isn't that interesting how many different reasons we were able to come up with beyond what she actually says? Now, of course, the reason why we're even able to suggest all these different things is another methodological point, which is that there's a world of difference between when a biblical narrator speaks and when characters speak. Right? If the narrator speaks, that's the objective voice of the text. That's the Navi talking to us. Navi always wins. Right? If people are talking, people still might be right. I don't doubt every single statement made by a human being in Tanakh. Obviously, many of these things are accurate and fine and excellent. But we also understand that people might have other motivations beyond what they say, and they also sometimes are just plain wrong. Sometimes they make mistakes, and sometimes you could even pin them down. What's great is when there's a clash between the narrator's perspective and a character's perspective, then you know the character is wrong. Because the narrator is telling you, by the way, here's the deal, or something like that. Even just simple little things, like when the Torah goes out of its way to say that Reuven intended to save Yosef. That helps, because now we know his motivations. We might have surmised that that's what was going on, but we weren't sure. Maybe he has other games to play by trying to save Yosef. Maybe he's trying to reassert his firstbornship, although, let me tell you, he's a biblical firstborn. He does not have a chance. But we'll dwell on that hang-up some other time. For our purposes now, well, you firstborns understand exactly what I'm talking about. But getting back to our issue at hand, since Naomi is the speaker for all of these psukim and the narrator never corroborates her, we don't know. Maybe there are other reasons she might have decided that it would be better to leave them behind. Okay, so here comes shiur number one. So what did Chazal say? By the way, quick stepping out of the shiur. There's no such thing as Chazal say, right? Chazal are a lot of different people who lived at a lot of different times and who almost never agree, right? Right, and that's good. We love learning for exactly this reason. So we understand that when somebody says Chazal say X, that's usually already a mistake. It's kind of like many people when they teach, they'll say the Mefarshim say. What that really means, you've all heard shiurim like this, what it really means when the Mefarshim say, it means Rashi says, right? Now that's good. Rashi is a fine person to quote. I quote him all the time myself. But just say, Rashi says this, and then there are 20 other people who have other points of view, and then we have a much better discussion of what the Mefarshim say. So I'm cheating by saying Chazal say, but I'm doing it on purpose, okay? So I'm conscious of the flaw of ever saying Chazal say. Chazal say in source number one. Again, I'm going to read in English, but you have the original Hebrew right in front of you as well. He was the prime mover, and his wife secondary to him, and his two sons secondary to both of them. This midrash is picking up on our discussion from last week, that Elimelech, Mahlon, Kilion, Naomi, their family, they were stingy bums. There was a famine going on, they were leaders of the community, they could have helped, and they up and go over to Moab, leaving their poor, suffering community behind. What horrible people. So what's this midrash saying? Whose fault is all of that? Elimelech. Why? He was the man of the house. He was the man of the house. He sat the family down one night at dinner and said, look, everybody's about to, there's a famine, I don't know how long it's going to go. We need to get out of here before all the beggars come. And the wife and children say, okay, tell us how much time we have to pack. You know, that's the way that this midrash understands it. They understand that Elimelech is the stingy one, and therefore Naomi is the passive victim of her own husband's stingy, selfish, terrible behavior. She had nothing at all to do with this. This is the point of view of Chazal, because we all know that Naomi is a fabulous Baalat Chesed. She is the one who looks out for her daughters-in-law. She's a very caring individual, not like her husband. Okay. That's point number one. Point number two, we see with our own eyes what her motivations are. She tells Rut and Orpah that even though they want to take care of her, they love her, they've been together for over a decade, that it's in their interest to stay in Moab. They'll find husbands there, they'll be with their societies, everything is better for them there. Please don't sacrifice your lives just to come take care of me. I'll find a way to manage. I'll miss you, but it doesn't matter. This is chesed of the, it's not just chesed, it's tremendous, tremendous self-sacrifice, what was said at the very outset of the whole discussion. Chazal then come up with a different reason, which some of us were tinkering with without actually just saying it, but I'm sure it was the backdrop of several of the comments that were made along the way. In source number two, Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani said in the name of Rav Yehuda bar Chanina, Three times it is written here, turn back. Meaning Naomi three times tried to dissuade her daughters-in-law from returning to Israel. Corresponding to the three times that a would-be proselyte is repulsed. But if he persists after that, he is accepted. So what's this midrash saying? First of all, it's predicated on the assumption that they have not yet converted. And not only that, let's plug it into our question. Why is Naomi trying to dissuade her daughters-in-law for coming? Huh? You're speaking on a sociological plane, and by the way, you're absolutely right in your sociological assumption. I don't know if this midrash is focusing on sociology here, though, as much as halakha. This is the din. That here, the daughters-in-law don't realize this. They're coming back because they're loving daughters-in-law. They're faithful. They're loving. They're wonderful. They want to help Naomi out. They want to be socially... They love her. Naomi says, you realize that by coming back with me, we're not going to Amon, where we're just going to worship some other patron deity over there with lots of other gods along the way. There's one God where I come from. And I need to know that you're sincere. When you come back with me, it's not enough to love me. You have to realize that you're adopting an entirely different religion and lifestyle. Are you up for that? And so when they start saying, sure, we're up for it. Well, her job is to try to dissuade them first. Not because it's wrong to deter converts for too far along the way, but because we have to make sure that they mean it. This is a halachic statement. Now, the question is, you understand, in terms of what really is what happened in the biblical period, we talked about this last time. I don't know exactly the protocols of conversion in the biblical period. None of us do. There's no way to know. But Ruth certainly becomes the paragon of a successful conversion case. Here's somebody who was a Moabite, and bam, by the end of the story, she's phenomenal, right? Even in this parak, what we just read, she proclaims her faithfulness to her people and to God. That's two for two as far as we are concerned. She's in for the long haul, she's sincere, all good stuff, and then she becomes David HaMelech's great-grandmother, so that's pretty solid. And so that's the halachic layer of this midrash, yeah?
Does she have any clue of what Judaism was all about at that time?
No clue. Meaning let's backpedal here. I have no clue if she had a clue. I don't know. I don't know what she was told by Naomi. Again, she was living in, quote-unquote, to be anachronistic here, a Jewish household for 10 years. So I don't know what they were doing over there. But if they were doing what normal Israelites did, meaning faithful normal Israelites, then she had 10 years of exposure, plus not only to Pesach Seders, but to lots of stuff, to day-to-day life within an Israelite household. So I don't know that she's only now, you know, signing up to find out what she's going to get. It could well be that she knows exactly what she's getting herself into from an observance. Whatever the family did, she knew about that, yeah? Midrashically, he was extremely well off, as in one of the wealthiest people of the community.
Did Naomi lose it?
All I can tell you is this. I don't know how wealthy Elimelech was.
She was still strength-like.
But Naomi is destitute when she comes back.
Are we assuming that?
Well, you don't glean if you're not destitute. Gleaning is horrible. Gleaning is horrible. I mean, again, I've never done it, but I mean, the worst thing I ever came close to that was working in kibbutzot on a chicken coop for like 4 hours. Horrible. I'm still traumatized by this, and I was like a sophomore in high school. Terrible. Gleaning is way worse, okay? Gleaning is 12 hours a day, bending over, hoping that the guys will drop a couple of stalks, competing with other beggars who are doing the same thing, clearly putting up with an awful lot of sexual harassment. How do I know, by the way? I'm not just surmising. Because Boaz orders the field workers not to harass Ruth. Okay, well, it's not surprising. These were incredibly vulnerable people who were willing to do anything just to pick up a couple of stalks of grain with the hopes of getting enough food for enough grain to make one day's meal. Okay, now you got to come back and do it again tomorrow for months. Oh, it's horrible.
In the burning heat.
Huh? Burning heat, no sunscreen. It's horrible. So Naomi is destitute. But then, looming in the backfield, just to finish this answer, there's some field somewhere that could be redeemed by the end of the story. Right, which had belonged to Elimelech. So what exactly the legality of that field is and how that figures into our story, fuzzy, and our Mefarshim and contemporary scholars continue to debate this. All I can tell you is Naomi starts off in Perek Bet dirt poor. She has no means of supporting herself at all, which is why Ruth is going over to the fields, you know, day and night to glean. Yeah.
With regard to how much Ruth learned of Yiddishkeit, obviously she learned a lot because she comes up with correct formula.
She was perfect.
So obviously she was exposed, as was Orpah, and she comes up with the right formula.
I'm all with you, just because, again, she lived in their home for over a decade, so she had a chance. It wasn't just that she took a crash course. She lived in a home for all that time.
And it's not like she just spit out the words which came out randomly. It was the right formula.
100%. So that all being said, and let's even take your thing one step further. Now, when you have a midrash like this, again, Chazal always can have a misora, they can have oral traditions that go all the way back. It could well be that Chazal are turning to Rut as the paradigm of how Giyur should work in the age of Halakha, and therefore they make this into a model for what rabbis need to do down the line. That's probably more likely in this case, although we can't always tell. But what's more important to me is, for today, is there anything in the text that we read so far that suggests this halachic reasoning? Or is this halachic man entering Megillat Rut? Both of them are good. Both of these are possibilities. One is a pshat-based drasha. Is this something that emerges from within the text? Or is this something that Chazal want to teach us about Giyur? In which case, it's a drasha. It's a very good drasha also, very important in terms of our testing the sincerity of a prospective convert. But is that really part of the intent of the text? Yeah. Traditionally, yes.
Well, didn't he write this with a specific agenda?
I don't know. What's the agenda?
Well, whatever, that to show that Ruth's ancestry may not have been, allowed to convert, but she had such exemplary behavior. She married being the great grandmother of everyone.
No, I mean, look, Chazal will have to deal with the problem of the Moabite thing on halachic grounds. In other words, can a Moabite woman convert? The answer, thank God, according to the opinions over there, is yes, which is why the Davidic dynasty is legitimate. That's important regardless of who wrote the book, by the way. That's just an important thing. We need to know that the Davidic dynasty is legitimate, and therefore the Moabite convert has to come into play. So Shmuel is as good as any other Navi for that purpose. What I'm more interested, though, is not... What you're saying is absolutely imperative to understanding this story, by the way. The Moabite feature is not just in the realm of Chazal, it's in the realm of the text, and we have to get back to that. We're going to get back to that today. But I'm interested for our purposes, though, for source number two. I'm just asking a much more basic question. Is there anything in the text that suggests that Naomi is testing the sincerity of the prospective converts? Or is that something that Chazal are drawing from our story in order to derive halachot of Giyur?
I think it's pretty evident from the text, because I don't think we see, unless I'm mistaken, that Orpah ever told Naomi back, I'm going back to my nation and to my God. That's Naomi essentially putting it into Orpah's words. It says, your sister-in-law went back to her nation and to her God. Right there, she's setting the stage.
I completely agree with you. I think that this midrash is Pshuto Shel Mikra. Not from a halachic standpoint necessarily, but from the point of view of the religious consequences of Rut and Orpah choosing which way to go is part of Pshat. Verse 15, which is what John is referring to, Pasuk Tetvav, is where Naomi says that she's gone back to her nation and to her God, or gods, right? And that's understood by the characters, that remaining in Moab isn't just a social decision to not accompany Naomi, it's a religious decision. Remain in Moab, you're going to marry a Moabite, you'll have Moabite children, you'll send them to Moabite day school. It's a whole another world. Tuitions are much lower, okay, in Moab. And that bothers me. But in the meantime, but that all being said, so what Chazal are doing here are setting up, we have a portrait that I'm trying to create here within these midrashim. Point number one from source number one is, Naomi is a passive victim of her husband's selfishness. She is lovely, he is a bum. Okay, point number one. Point number two, not only is it evident that she's a balat chesed of the first order because she's so concerned with her daughters-in-law, but Chazal detect she really cared about the religious sincerity of her daughters-in-law. This is in the text. This is something that was on her mind and is in our text. It's quote-unquote not just a halachic passage, not that that's a just, but it's not coming from a Chazal perspective onto the text. It's something that emerges from within the text. I think the two of you said this earlier as well before. And therefore, we have to go back and just read the text, and this goes back to something that you were saying in verse 13. Naomi clearly is motivated by these two superb reasons to deter her daughters-in-law. One is just chesed for them, and the other one is religious sincerity. She wants to make sure that they understand what they're really going to be getting into for the long haul. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, going back, we're just going to keep on reading the same Psukim. Halahen tisaber. Now, are you going to wait for these children, these fictional children of mine to grow up? Ad asher yigdalu halahen teagena levilti ayod leish. Al benotai, ki mar li me'od mikam. What does that mean? What does that expression mean? Ki mar li me'od mikam. Huh?
Very bitter, bitter because of you.
Right, well, not in this reading. That's your number two. Well, how do you read it now?
On your behalf.
I'm bitter on your behalf, correct. Or I'm even more bitter than you. That's fine. Like, why do you want to stay with me? I'm having a horrible time. I lost my husband. I lost my sons. You want to stay with me? Either one of those two readings. I mean, if I shouldn't debate the meaning of this. So these two readings fit the persona that we're dealing with over here, okay? Meaning here we're dealing with somebody who is bereaved. She's utterly miserable. And she says, I'm so bitter on your behalf. You've suffered a lot too. You've lost your husbands. I'm looking out for you. This is your best bet. So Naomi is just fabulous. And the whole Megillah runs this way. And the whole Megillah, Paragimel kicks off with Naomi saying, Ruth, I have to find you a husband. Here's our opportunity. We're going to do this really interesting threshing floor thing with Boaz, basically involving a proposal where she's going to show up, and by the end of the day, Boaz will understand that Ruth would like to marry him. And thankfully, Boaz eventually comes through in the clutch. And so throughout the entire Megillah, Naomi is riveted, concerned for her daughters-in-law. She saves the day by rigging this whole marriage with Boaz. She gets it to happen. I am so happy at the end of the Megillah where, it's kind of weird actually, but I'm so happy about it, that at the very end, if you go to Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayikach Boaz et Rut, Vatihi lo li'isha, Vayavoy le, Vayitena Hashem la, Herayom vatel et ben. Okay, so Boaz marries Rut, they have a child, they have a son. Vatomarna hanashim el Naomi, the women say to Naomi, Baruch Hashem, asher lo ishbit lach goel hayom. Blessed be God, who has not deprived you of a goel, a redeemer today. Vikare shemo b'Yisrael. Ve'haya lach l'meshiv nefesh u'falkel tevatech. He'll take care of you in your old age. Ki chalatech asher ahevatech yaladatu asher hi tova lach mishiva banim. And your daughter-in-law, she's wonderful. She's better than seven sons. Batikach Naomi et hayeled v'tishiteu b'cheikah v'tilo lo menet. Naomi is in the last scene, as the camera is beginning to fade out. She's holding the baby. She's the toast of the town. All the women are there cheering her on. They're praising, what a wonderful shidduch over here. Boaz is a zillionaire. He'll take care of you in your old age. And Ruth is the ultimate balat chesed. And she's your daughter-in-law. She is superb. Everything is great. And then, Vatikrena lo hashchenot shem lemor. These women folk have a big role. They get to name the kid. Yulad ben le Naomi. A son has been born to Naomi. Vatikrena shemo oved hu avi yishai avi David. Okay. I like the fact that Naomi, who was willing to sacrifice it all by looking out for her daughters-in-law, who had the religious integrity to deter her daughters-in-law, making sure that they're sincere in their conversion, she gets it all in the end. She has a wealthy son-in-law, who might be older than she is, but that doesn't matter. Well, it's quasi-son-in-law, however you want to worry about the relation here. Whatever it is, wealthy Boaz is taking care of her, redeemed the field. Ruth is phenomenal, taking care of her also. She is set. Plus, she even is holding the baby. I love that. And all her friends are back. She went from being destitute, ruined, miserable, to being toast of the town. And she deserves it. She was phenomenal. And then again, that goes back to last week, whether we should view this as divine reward for her outstanding chesed, or we should view this as fair consequences to somebody who just is so wonderful. That's your number one. And now I'm going to have a sip of water. To conclude, Shior number one, source number three, Darshan's the name the way that you would expect her name to be, Darshan. Rav Yehoshua ben Korcha was wont to interpret names, and the name of his wife was Naomi, for her actions were pleasant and sweet. You better believe it. Naomi, that was an easy one. Naomi, it means sweet, pleasant, all of these good things. Absolutely. Good. All right, that's Shiur number one. Now, okay, Shiur number two. So now I'm just going to pretend that I didn't say anything, and I'm going to try to do another Shiur, right? So, you see, the real reason that Naomi didn't want Ruth and Orpah to return with her is because they were Moabites, and she hated that. They were a stigma. She was so, like, here she was. She came from, whether she was nobility or whether she was just an upstanding family, it doesn't even matter. She's an Israelite. And we don't like Moabites. We really don't. We have a prohibition against marrying them. And even with the halachic dispensation that the men can marry their women folk if they convert, doesn't matter. There was a terrible stigma against Moab. And the last thing Naomi needs after 10 years of being away from her community is to come back. No husband, no sons, two Moabites. Bad. So what she needs to do is find a way to get rid of them. So what she could say is, sweethearts, we've gotten along great, we've had a fine relationship, I always have enjoyed playing bridge with you. But you're Moabites and I can't stand you and you can't come back with me, so just stay here. She could have said it that way. But what you do in Marketing 101 is you say, here's why it's good for you. Right? And that's a far more persuasive argument. She's going to say, look, you'll never find a husband if you come back. I don't have anybody. I have no sons. I'm not going to get married. I'm old. Even if I could get married and have a child, it'll never grow up in time for you. Stay here. It is in your interest. And Chazal say, they understand that she actually was far stingier than she sounds. Source number four, Chazal say, in Rut Zutah, just a quick footnote, what is Rut Rabbah and Rut Zutah? Rut Rabbah tends to be more famous because it's Midrash Rabbah. Rut Zutah is the one that kind of gets, you know, lost in the shuffle. There's not one person who wrote Rut Rabbah and one person who wrote Rut Zutah. It's compilations of different Midrashim. And what does Rabbah mean? It's the big. And what does Zutah mean? Small. Okay, so guess what? One collection was bigger than the other one. So that's how it goes. So the big one is called Rut Rabbah, and the small one is called Rut Zutah. But again, it's not one opinion against another. So there are plenty of opinions within Rut Rabbah, and there are plenty of opinions within Rut Zutah. So source number four. Why did the text mention him, his wife, and his children? To teach that all of them were stingy. She's not a passive victim of anything. When Elimelech and Naomi and Mahlon and Kilion ditched the community, they talked about it. Everybody had input, and it was a 4-0 unanimous decision. Let's get out of here. Let's ditch this town. Chazal say. See, that's why you're not allowed to say Chazal say, because, well, I just gave another shiur with a different Chazal. But okay, fine. But Chazal say right over here that Naomi was an active player in this. And obviously they understood that Naomi wasn't as great as she sounds. She certainly sounds very chesedika. Can't argue with that one. She clearly is only expressing her feelings toward her daughters-in-law. But this midrash sees right through that one. This midrash says, nope, she was plenty stingy, which is why Chazal had to come along also in Rut Zutah, source number 5. Why did Naomi want to return them? So that she would not be embarrassed by them. We find that there were 10 markets in Jerusalem, and they, the classes of people who shopped at each, never intermingled. The people were recognized by their clothing. What each class wore, another would not. Chazal make it perfectly clear that she was worried about the Moabite stigma, and that her daughters-in-law would be at the bottom of the whole pecking order. They would have to wear, you know, Moabite clothes, ugh, and shop just in the Moabite shuk, and then they would be attached to her. She couldn't have that. She had to get rid of them. She, you know, ditched her community in the first place, and now she's sounding so gracious to her daughters-in-law, but Chazal see right through that. They're very clear. Now, what's the biggest text proof that Chazal are right? It's very interesting, actually. What's Naomi's whole argument to try to dissuade Rut and Orpah from coming back? What does she say? Forgetting about what her motives are now. What does she say? You'll never find a husband. All right. Who's more rock solid than Boaz? The answer is nobody. Boaz is awesome, right? And you know that when Ruth came to Boaz at that threshing floor scene, so she basically proposes marriage. And we all know that Boaz is going to say yes because the story really would not work if Boaz declined. But what's astonishing is what Boaz does say, and that's in source number 6. This is in Megillat Ruth. He exclaimed, "Be blessed of the Lord, daughter." Not a very romantic line in our day and age. But in that day and age, it actually made sense because there was a generation gap, actually. That's how an elder person would address the younger one. And look, it's not an unromantic thing to say, even though romance doesn't seem to be the primary point of our story. But in the meantime, your latest deed of loyalty is greater than the first. Wow! You want to marry me? Old Boaz? That's incredible. That's even a greater act of loyalty than your first one, presumably. What was her first act of loyalty? Leaving Moab and leaving her family and leaving everything to accompany Moab and take care of her. This is even more impressive. In that, you have not turned to younger men, whether poor or rich. Boaz took for granted that Ruth could have had any man she wanted. Rock solid Boaz, black on white, at the threshing floor, woken up in the middle of the night, quite startled by the whole thing, is flabbergasted that Ruth wants to marry him because he's so old. He's very rich, but it doesn't matter. Because I'll actually derive from this that a woman would rather be with a peer than with, you know, the wealthy 80-year-old billionaire. Right? In other words, Chazal derived from this verse. Now, at least most women are like that. Apparently, there are exceptions. But in the meantime, but Boaz himself, the billionaire in our story, is blown away that Ruth didn't just choose any other man in the town. Meaning, Ruth could have found a shidduch. Naomi's thing was a ruse. She was doing everything she could to get rid of Ruth and Orpah. But in fact, in practice, Boaz doesn't see this at all. Boaz lives there and is shocked and in fact, like, bursting with chesed feelings here. It's like, wow, your loyalty. By the way, the loyalty isn't that she wants to marry Boaz. The loyalty is to, going back to our earlier conversation, you want to marry me to preserve Mahlon's name, meaning you'd rather marry an old relative to preserve the name of Mahlon. That's incredible loyalty to Mahlon. Instead of just marrying somebody you meet. Yeah?
It's just then that since Boaz was the shofet, he knew the halacha of Mahlon. The other people didn't know it as well. Therefore, to them, they would not have wanted to know.
Your point is well taken, and not only within Chazal, but within the text itself, that this Ploni Almoni guy in Perek Dalet, at least some of his reason for declining marriage to Ruth is because she's a Moabite. So your point is very well taken in the realm of Pshuto Shel Mikra also. That all being said, all I need from this pasuk for this part of the shiur is to say, Boaz doesn't think that Ruth doesn't have a chance. In other words, the starting point of the story is that Boaz transcends everything by being willing to marry her. It's amazing, actually, and we'll talk about him next week. But for this week, I'm just using his, you know, state of shock comment, matter of fact, that, wow, you could have married anybody and you chose to marry me. What an amazing act of chesed, as opposed to, you had no choice anyway, it's good for you for at least coming around. Right? His tone is that this was, she really could have married anybody, yeah. Oh, yes, it does. Right? And so, help me out. So what does it mean in the second shiur?
In the second shiur, it means, you're dragging me by the neck.
That's exactly right. So let's read the psukim again. Go back to Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Here we go again. Naomi, take three. Right? Halahen tis haberna asher yigdalu, halahen te hagena levoti hayo leish. Al benotaki mar li me'od mikem, ki yatza'a biyad Hashem. Chazal say in source number 7, just to follow your point, nay, my daughters, translate, woe is me, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes. It's amazing that biblical characters could speak in Old English. It blows me away every time. Meaning, on account of you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. In other words, it's your fault. Marli meod mikem, I'm bitter because of you. It's your fault, whether or not. That's Pshuto Shel Mikra. It's certainly a fair reading in Pshat. And let's keep on going with this one. Batisena kolan, batibkena od, batishak or palachamotavru tavakaba, batomer, hine shava yivintech, lamavelelelelo, ashubi achra yivintech, batomer root, pasuk tazayin, batomer root, al tifki e bil ozvech lashuv meacharaich. What does al tifki e b mean? Huh? See, we're already sold on the second shiur. In the first shiur, I would have told you, it means like Rufigu Lugan from Ben Sochar. It means don't entreat me. Right, go get the guy who's going to help sell me this cave with the field. That's all it means. The shoresh of paga, pei gimel ayin, can mean entreat, but it also can mean wound, attack. Stop harassing me. Right? This shoresh, a lot is riding on which slant you're taking in the first place. Right? In other words, you could easily read this one way. Please don't entreat me anymore. It's like, I understand you're trying to deter me, but I'm sincerely committed to you. The second one is, leave me alone. I'm really coming with you. I swear to God, only death will separate us. And so Ruth then proclaims her unbelievable fidelity to Naomi, and more impressively from our perspective, to our nation and to God. And then Pasuk Yudchet, Vaterek himit ametzet hi lalechet ita vatechdal edaber eleha. When Naomi saw that Ruth was very persistent in her ways, she stopped talking to her. So she, you're number one. What does that mean? She stopped trying to dissuade her, and they talked about the weather and continued along in their friendly, merry way. And according to the second reading,
she stops talking
to her.
Helping her, surely.
Yeah.
What would be Ruth's motivation then if Naomi is being so mean and nasty and her way and talking to her? Why continue on with her?
It's not in her interest, right? No, she's giving up a lot by not only abandoning her society, but staying with somebody who's trying to dissuade her.
Yeah, what's the point?
10 days.
She loves her and is committed to our people and to God. She's doing a lot. The amount of self-sacrifice that Ruth does on either reading is phenomenal, by the way.
Yeah, but the first one you can understand because there's a love there. So even though she says it's going to be hard for me, so okay, I love you and I want to go. But the second way, why continue on?
Right, so I'm going to need the end of the shiur to answer you better. Okay, so before we get to the end of the shiur, though, let's just play out the rest of this parak. Vatelachnan shtehem. First number, pasuk 19, yotet. Vatelachnan shtehem, bo'ana beit lachem. Vahiki bo'ana beit lechem, vatehom kol ha'ir alehem, vatomarna zot naomi. So again, being a New Yorker, I cannot help but realize, you know, I can't help. It's terrible. Okay, so here's a bunch of, you know, here's the little town, and Naomi and Ruth are coming along the way, and of course you picture that one woman holding her chicken sees them, rubs her eyes, like, that's Naomi. She drops her chicken, comes running. Before you know it, all the women are there. Like, as they're marching, it's an amazing scene, actually, how quickly everybody is mobilized to make this happen. Is this really Naomi? Stop calling me pleasantness, call me bitterness, because God has dealt with me very bitterly. So in the first reading, she's the devastated, destitute woman that we've discussed. She lost her husband, she lost her sons, this wonderful woman. She feels totally, totally bitter, and she feels embittered that God has deprived her of everything. In the second reading, she says, I left full, and now I come back empty, and standing right next to her is the chopped liver of the weak. Because here, Ruth has just given up everything, right? She's given up her family, her society, her culture, everything, her religion. She comes right on in there. She's accompanying Naomi, is ready to take care of her, and Naomi says, I'm back empty. Both tracks are true, right? And both tracks seem to be here, and then just to finish the parak, and we'll wrap it all up. Atashov Naomi Veruta Moavia Kalata Ima. Notice the italics, maybe I should say it a little differently, right? Atashov Naomi Verut Hamoavia Kalata Ima, right? In other words, we already knew she was a Moabite, but suddenly this seems to be looming prominently in our minds, and it's certainly going to figure prominently for the duration of the narrative. Hashava Misde Moav, just in case you forgot where they were from, Vehema Bao Beit Lechem Etchilat Kitzir Selrim, and that kicks off the whole Boaz thing, which is great, and we'll talk about that next time. One last midrash from Chazal, darshaning Naomi's name. All the city was astir concerning them, and the woman said, is this Naomi? Now they're going to darshan the name to also mean that it comes from pleasantness, because that's what Naomi means. It's really easy to do that. But look how this midrash in Midrash Rabbah translates pleasant actions. Is this the one whose actions were fitting and pleasant, Naomim? In the past she used to go in a litter, and now she walks barefoot. And you say, is this Naomi? In the past she wore a cloak of fine wool, and now she is clothed in rags. And you say, is this Naomi? Before, her countenance was ruddy from abundance of food and drink, and now it is sickly from hunger. And yet you say, is this not what meaning? How are they translating Masan Imim? Pleasantness, her pleasant actions. It's self-indulgent. Again, there's nothing bad about eating good food and having ruddy cheeks as opposed to being pale and sickly. There's nothing negative in this character of Naomi in reading number two, and I think that's what's important to notice. But Chazal in the second track are saying that Naomi speaks chesed, but she obviously is looking out for herself. Right? That's the whole point of shiur number two, that she gained more than anybody. She has the baby at the end, she has her field redeemed, she has wealthy Boaz financing the whole thing. Everything is looking very good, and she's the one who rigged the whole picture. So, now that we've had both shiurim, and I'm still standing, it's not easy to do this, at least not for me. The only reason I was able to give both of these shiurim is because I'm totally persuaded by both of them. I can't give a shiur if I don't think that it's true. What's weird about this situation is that I'm totally convinced that Naomi is the superb Balat Chesed of reading number one, completely looking out for her daughters-in-law, sacrificing so much to make it happen. She really looks out for Ruth, she cares for her needs, and I'm delighted that she's holding that baby at the end and that her field is redeemed and everybody's happily ever after. It's great. And part of me was completely persuaded by the second reading that she all along was trying to ditch her Moabite daughters-in-law. When that failed, she found a way to get Ruth to do what was necessary to make that happy ending happen at the end, where she suddenly is doing that. And Chazal hit both facets of the story. Right, shiur number one is simply one track within Chazal. They're picking up on one thing, and it has to do with how you read Al Tif Ki'i Bi. It has to do with how you read Ki Marli Me'od Mikem. The expressions that we saw were ambiguous. But it all comes down to, I think it comes back to your question. Naomi is certainly not just person number two who's trying hard to dissuade her daughters-in-law. She loves her daughters-in-law. She has a deep relationship with them. And simultaneously, she's also looking out for herself. And there's nothing bad about looking out for herself. The point of the story, the way that's coming across, is she does tremendous chesed, and it benefits Boaz and Ruth. She's not harming them. But it also benefits herself, and she just doesn't say that part. So that's what the second track of Chazal are trying to pick up on. Chazal are trying to pick up on the fact that there's nothing bad about, you know, when you're selling things and trying to make a living. Okay, so you're going to tell the customer why this is the best thing that will change your life and make your life better. You're not going to say, I also am trying to earn a living, right? But it's not bad to want to earn a living. Right? There's nothing negative in that. It's simply what you're doing in marketing. Naomi, according to the second line of Midrash, is a good marketer. She's promoting, it's in your interest and not focusing on, but it's also in my interest. You were going to say something before.
Is it possible that theory number one was accurate? They wouldn't call it Megillat Naomi?
It's an excellent question in general about, by the way, I wouldn't have been bothered had it been called Megillat Naomi. But then again, you could have called Megillat Esther Megillat Mordechai, and I think we'd all be cool with that too. Right? So in other words, there are several protagonists, whoever, I mean, it's an ancient, this is the ancient name of the book. I mean, Chazal call it Megillat Rut also. So it goes back very, very, very far. I don't know why they chose Rut as opposed to the others, although personally, I think they made the right choice. Tune in next week and you'll find out just how much I think that. I think it's fantastic. But it would have been fine with Megillat Naomi, or frankly, Megillat Boaz. Boaz actually, if you're just from the department of who speaks more in the Megillat, Boaz actually says more lines than anybody else. So Boaz could have easily been the protagonist too, even though the women clearly dominate the scene. Yeah.
Isn't it irrelevant with one or two? Doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference, one or two, because the story is about Ruth, the great grandmother of David. And Ruth doesn't change, no matter which.
She doesn't. And we'll talk about her more next week also. Okay, a couple last things, then we're going to wrap it up so that we can officially end on time. Yeah?
Just saying, number one, it had to have been, in my opinion, known Ruth, because again, the reason it was written supposedly by Shmuel was to justify David being Malka.
I'm all good with that, and I have 50 other reasons why I like Ruth over the other characters for the name as well. Yeah?
But the second point is, you know, there's another way of looking at Midrash too, and as the concept, maybe that she wasn't doing this conscious, maybe she just happened to go along and do it this way. You know, like, she wasn't aware that she was looking out for herself. You know, she just happened to, that was her.
That's also fair. You can say that
maybe
the second Midrash
story goes along as God going over and pushing everybody into this position, you know, and then it becomes.
Right, so you could argue that this is the subconscious of the text, so to speak. I can't disagree. All I can tell you is that I believe that the text is deliberately portraying both of these sides. I'm persuaded by both tracts of Chazal here in Shoshal Mikra that Naomi is simply a complex character. She's superb bala chesed, and simultaneously, which again is not a bad thing, making sure that she's taking care of her own needs. Tune in next week for our last session when we go into Prakim Bet and Gimel and Dalet and talk about Boaz and Ruth. Thank you so much again. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you, everybody.